On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
I'm joined in the studio by Kevin Doyle, the group head of news at the Irish Independent and Grainne Lea, journalist with the journal.ie. You're very welcome and a great morning. A really good morning.
Yeah, it's hard to know when you peak at a quarter past 6 on a Sunday morning, where do you go from there after that? It has been, and it does seem that an awful lot of people were up out of their bed at that time in the morning. So I have to say, I'm feeling a bit exhausted, a bit euphoric, and maybe, dare I say it, even a little bit emotional. It was a lot to take in before you've properly woken up in the morning to the sheer, how she held it together going into the ring. She held it together for the fight, obviously. It just seemed like her entire body seemed to go into shock afterwards. The tears, the clear emotion in her eyes, even wearing the mask, you could nearly see through the mask the emotion. So it really was an extraordinary morning. And you know what, Sean? I think we needed it.
Yeah, definitely a big lift after the week that was. And Grainne, it was like one of those ones where you could just see straight away how much it meant to her and how much work had gone into this.
And as, you know, all the analysts have been saying, she really had to perform at her best to get there and seemed to do that effortlessly. You know, you get a bit nervous when you see someone in a final. You're like, there's pressure. You're up against a really good fighter. You know, it's not another world champion in the ring with her. And she lost the first round, which is really, really difficult. Out of three, it's really difficult to prove to the judges that you were the better competitor in the ring. And she did it with flair and she did it with confidence. And she looked so comfortable from the moment she stepped into that ring, so comfortable. Not just an amazing boxer, but an amazing advocate for young people, for working hard at whatever you do. You know, that piece in the Sunday Times you quoted from talks about how boxing clubs wouldn't accept a girl when she started out. And, you know, they talk about the money challenges as well that come with it. And any one bit of wavering from Harrington, you know, she talked about the final stretch being lonely, but actually the build up is so tough, if not maybe not lonely, but very, very tough. And it's such a lesson in perseverance, because if any faltering had happened on the money or on, you know, the gender issue in that she kind of faced as she was training to do what she wanted to do, we wouldn't have an Olympic champion today, maybe.
That Sunday Times piece, I want to quote a bit more from it because it's a really, really good profile and a difficult one, Kevin, as I'm sure you'll know, having planned the paper for this morning, to plan when there's a fight at 6 a.m. and you know it's going to be the big story without knowing the result. But anyway, Kelly talks about having left school at the age of 14. She says, I never did homework. I was in detention every day. It wasn't for me. I had no discipline. I was gone in second year. Academically, not the greatest. Streetwise, I was very, very clued in. People that back then who looked at me would have said, she's destined for a life behind bars. She's destined to be dead before she's 25. I was hanging around in the flats and drinking. I've been to dark places sometimes and I've had to pinch myself. Am I here now? I feel like even still, I'm making it up to my ma and da, even at this stage in my life. And Kevin, there's no more making it up to today and no more for people who are maybe in that sort of a dark place of their life to show you can turn it around and you can come from somewhere where you're in such a dark place and yet get out of it.
Yeah, and I'm conscious that a lot of people in the world of sport will obviously have been following Kelly Harrington for quite a few years, but in the broader country, she would not be anywhere near as well known as Katie Taylor, say when Katie Taylor was going to the London Olympics in the hunt for gold. So for a lot of people, they don't know the backstory there. They don't fully know, I suppose, what Kelly Harrington had to overcome to get to today. And that what you just read out there, Sean, that description of a girl who left school at 14 because she couldn't behave herself and was on going down a particular bad path. Like, could that be any more different than the girl this morning with the tears in her eyes as the tricolour was lifted and her Aron Aveen was playing out in Tokyo? It's very hard to almost put those two girls side by, well, one a girl, now the other a woman, side by side. And I'm also very conscious that Portland Roe, which has obviously been all over the papers in a very positive way in the last couple of weeks, I'm trying to explain to people where exactly that is, because I've reported on it. I've been to events where Kelly Harrington has spoke down there to try and get that community to pick itself up. Like after the Regency Hotel atrocity, that whole area around Kelly Harrington's home that people will be seeing on the news this evening with her parades practically, like those streets were walked by armed guardie day and night. There was checkpoints everywhere. It was uncomfortable. My own office, the Irish Independent office, is not too far. It's around the corner pretty much from Portland Row. It was a tense place. It was a dark place. It was kind of a horrible place. And I'm not saying that as a reflection of the good people who lived there, but that's the atmosphere that they lived in. And today, to see them out dancing in the streets to Hakuna Matata and, you know, We Are the Champions and all the rest of it, it's just wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful for them. And it's just such a kind of a rebirth, hopefully, for that part of Dublin City.
Mm. And it's to go back to the fight maybe for a little bit, Grania, and Mick sort of mentioned it there in his interview, and even though he's training, he's getting the calls from 7-year-old girls. We don't like seeing little girls punched in the face. That is the reality of things. And yet, there is going to be a lot of girls who are inspired to get into the ring. And that's a good thing, I think.
When he said that, I thought, well, we don't like them getting punched, but we like seeing them punched.
Yeah.
In the ring. You know, isn't that the difference? So, I think it was like a fight between power and control. The control Kelly Harrington had in the ring to hold back and to dodge, and the way she danced, and you could see her flip from orthodox to southpaw, and it was magic. It was like just the flick of the foot, and it was so artistic almost the way she did it. It was so enjoyable to watch.
I love how Grania's become an expert boxing analyst over the course of the Olympics.
Your secret passion.
Because I have to admit, I still had a clue what way the score was going this morning watching
well,
that.
Well, I kind of have a little bit of an interest in boxing. I actually, Zahra Antia is, I was at his son's wedding in Georgia a couple of years ago. So I kind of, it's been around me. And Zahra, like, there's a great piece in the Sunday Independent today about him as a trainer. The amount, 9 Olympic boxing medals under his watch, and as he says himself, it should have been 11.
Mm. Yeah.
We won't talk about Rio.
No,
but he has been an incredible guide for the boxer. And you saw after the first round, he jumped into the ring and he was talking to Kelly. That is an important guidance, and he's an incredible coach and a trainer, and a really interesting backstory to him as well, coming from Georgia and the Georgian community in Ireland. But it is just a great story, isn't that? What the Olympics? That's what you get sucked into. It's not just the sports in isolation, it's the backstories to that.
Mm.
But funding is so important. You know, you talk about the funding for the boxers and the time they need. That's just to give them the time to train, to reach their maximum potential. And they talk about, you know, the US athletes on the track and field, they haven't won as much gold medals because they haven't had the time to train because of the pandemic and funding and all of that. It all ties in together. You can't take one from the other. Obviously, there's raw talent there with Katie Taylor and Kelly Harrington, but it takes a lot of hard work to get to where they did. And it's so much more impressive the obstacles they faced to get there.
Yeah, and I think the fact that she overcame a truly class fighter in the final as well, in what was one of the great boxing finals we've ever seen. Listen, there's going to be plenty more talk about that later in the show with Neil Tracy of Off the Ball, and plenty more in the papers over the days to come, no doubt. And it's across all the front pages, guys. It is Merrion Gates, this scandal, as Albert Reynolds said, well, the small things trip you up, Kevin, and this has certainly been a trip.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's quite obvious, Sean, from all the papers this morning that it's not over.
Mm.
There are very obvious attempts within there to try and end it. We have the Taoiseach on the front of the Sunday Independent and in the Mail, I think, as well. Kind of taking a minor dig at Leo Varadkar in terms of using the phrase personal responsibility, which is kind of putting out that idea that he should have known better, really, but simultaneously saying, look, we need to move on. We're going to do a roadmap for how we all get out of this and we end all of these restrictions altogether by the end of August. So maybe that's what we should focus on. So there is an attempt to move it on. But I think there's so many questions that still remain. And I think Leo Varadkar's appearance on Friday evening on the television, which I suppose was an attempt by him to end the accusation that he was in hiding, I don't think it answered a whole load of the questions that journalists legitimately have and people legitimately have. So there's a bit to run in it yet, but I think what's obvious from the papers, and you see the Sunday Business Post talking about Fáilte Ireland saying that they had previously, or it said that Fáilte Ireland had previously been looking for clarification on the guidelines. Leo Varadkar said in that interview on Friday that the guidelines were updated, but not because of what happened at the Catherine's of Home party. I don't think anybody believes that. And there is an awful element, as you read through all the articles and all the analysis of this today, there's an awful element here that people feel the government are insulting our intelligence.
Mm. It does kind of, Grania, put a nonsense to this idea that, you know, there are very fixed rules and we all need to stick to them if the tarnished has done something or there has been this party and suddenly exemptions are made. I mean, in terms of just keeping people stuck with the restrictions and that social solidarity,
yeah,
out the window.
It's so cynical as well to retrospectively say, oh, we're just, actually the guidelines aren't clear and we'll just clarify them. That I don't think anybody heard that and took that at face value. you know, and it does speak to the lack of transparency around why the rules that, or the guidelines, I suppose, are in place, why they're there. And Colin Murphy has a good piece in the Sindo today about how, you know, that report earlier in the week about a lack of transparency was kind of proven then by that controversy around why the guidelines are in place and what is the thinking behind them. But I think that, you know, even though Varadkar's interview on Friday didn't make things worse, he, you know, it did kind of temper, maybe it kind of kept things at an even pace, I suppose. But that phrase, probably within the guidelines, is lovely, isn't it? Mm. Because it kind of sounds like, yes, they were within the guidelines.
I probably could have won an Olympic medal if I'd bothered training.
You kind of think in your head, okay, it was within the guidelines. That's actually not what was said. It's a lovely kind of holding pattern kind of for not answering the question. It wasn't within the guidelines. Mm. I mean, if you look at what up to 200 people were allowed, it was within venues that can hold up to 5,000 people. I'm not going to go counting bedrooms in the Merriam, but I'm guessing that's not what was meant. And then also, you know, the kind of the social aspect was up to 15, I think, last time we heard. They're very different rules to what the event in the Merriam was. And I don't think there's any way around that. That's, I suppose, the government are trying to move away from that now because we're kind of on the way out of those types of regulations and restrictions anyway. There'll be 40,000 people at a GAA final eventually. But the problem is the public perception and the public solidarity to stay with those guidelines. You need the leaders of the country to be sticking to the rules that they're telling everyone else to abide by. That is the core part of why we've gotten to where we have in this pandemic. And it is so cynical to expect people to say, oh yeah, it was fine when the leaders and the people running the country did that, and we still have to stick to the rules.
As Kevin kind of touched on there, the Business Post article does sort of make a nonsense of Varadkar's interview on Friday, though, doesn't it? Because he said, the guidelines were a bit wishy-washy, they were open to interpretation, when Fáilte Ireland themselves had been seeking better interpretation from the government in the first place.
Yeah, and I don't think that's surprising. A lot of businesses have been saying, you know, we sought guidance on whether we could have an event of 200 people, separate tables, all that, or six at a table, and we're told that wasn't allowed by Fáilte Ireland. The fact of the matter, if the guidelines say a 50-person event in a hospitality setting isn't allowed, then it's not allowed. Mm. You know, that's how it works. That's how we've been operating the past couple of months. And we are in a great place at the moment. There's really high vaccination rates, you know, really high uptake among young people, particularly as well. We're on a really good track. You know, Luke O'Neill's talking about 90% of adults being vaccinated at some point. That's incredible. Mm. The government really didn't need this, and they really didn't have to do it either. And this defending, I think the Mail makes the point, they're writing about the political backlash, and they're saying that, you know, to defend Zappone, who isn't a government minister, isn't in cabinet, and that event that was organised, it just doesn't make sense. And the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, saying we move on.
But
was
ultimately,
a real...
they're not defending Zappone, though. Isn't that the point here? Because Dara Cailleary didn't organise the Oireachtas Golf Society dinner. Phil Hogan didn't organise it. They just happened to show up. They happened to check with the hotel manager and the organisers of the event. Mm. And so we've had this whole episode. And ultimately, what it does break down to is, what is the difference between Dara Cailleary and Leo Varadkar? And the answer, as I see it, the answer to that question is that Dara Cailleary was disposable. Leo Varadkar is not, because that could threaten the entire government.
And this is the second scandal to hit Varadkar as well, after the cabinet leak. So he's pretty, you know, I don't know how many lives he has left, political lives he
well,
has left.
That's an interesting question to pick up on, because the Sunday Times does have two controversies involving the Tornadh on its front page in both of those stories. Kevin, where is his standing in Fine Gael at the moment? Because people I'm talking to say that Teflon-ness that he had a couple of years ago is well gone.
Oh, I think the Teflon is very much gone, and you know, he's very much in a different space now. He is seen as, you know, if you think back to when he was did the leadership and he had all these people in his back pocket before the campaign even gone away, and it looked like Simon Coveney couldn't find a friend for love nor money within the parliamentary party at that stage. It's not like that anymore. And at that time, people probably struggled to imagine a time when Leo Varadkar wouldn't be popular within the party, because he wined and dined and he chatted and he was available and all of those things that people like in a party leader. He is more distant now. You do expect that when you become the leader and you become the Taoiseach, or as he is now, the Tánaiste / future Taoiseach. But there's no doubt that people are struggling to see how this plays out, that it, the next election, which is a while away to be fair, but the next election is right now being set up as Leo Varadkar versus Mary Lou MacDonald. And the perception, or certainly the narrative around those two politicians, is very, very different. So, you know, Micheál Martin is kind of somewhat irrelevant in terms of talking about where we go next in the next election and all the rest of it. It's Leo Varadkar versus Mary Lou MacDonald. And Leo Varadkar right now constantly seems to have a whiff of scandal off him, whereas Mary Lou MacDonald seems to just go around as the queen bee almost. And, you know, her popularity is quite high. And, you know, it's a totally different thing around Mary Lou MacDonald. So it's a tricky time for Leo Varadkar. There's no doubt about that. But we're not talking heaves or anything like that. Let's not get too carried away either.
No, but there is some machination towards the leadership of Fine Gael. And I think the Sunday Times gets into that with this sort of Agatha Christie-esque thing that went on with a junior minister trying to trap a senior minister to discover who'd leaked this news about Catherine's opponent. And the suggestion has been made that, look, governments don't get a fourth term in office in Ireland. It rarely ever, if ever, has happened. Probably has happened with Fianna Fáil at some point in the past. But the likes of Leo Varadkar, the likes of Simon Coveney, the likes of Pascal Donoghue may all have their eyes on European jobs in the future and have made moves towards that in the past. And so there is a vacuum, or could be a vacuum.
There could be. Someone said to me, the longer Helen McEntee can stay on maternity leave, she might come back as party leader, the way things are going. There's no doubt. I mean, the Leo Varadkar's future has long been speculated on. So even before the last election, there was, do you remember when all the European jobs were up, the president of the European Council, even Ursula von der Leyen's job on the commission, his name was speculated on. And those jobs are due back up again in 2024 before the next general election. So there are some people in the back of their mind wonder if Leo Varadkar is Taoiseach, he would have a very good chance, because especially for the European Council, they like those people to be a prime minister going into those roles rather than a minister or something lower. So, and that was one of the questions around Ursula von der Leyen as well at the time was, well, you know, she was a defence minister and whatever in Germany, but was she of big enough stock to take on that role? So there is still some who believe that Leo Varadkar has his eye on that prize, and might even go before the next election if it came up. Then the Simon Coveney has forever been speculated. I mean, he was an MEP. There was a lot of talk when Phil Hogan left or was forced out that Simon Coveney could have been in the reckoning for that, and that he would have got a particularly good job in the European Commission. So that's been talked about, and obviously he's a lot of work with the UN now as well. So he will have some standing in terms of Ireland's place for the next 2 years in the UN. And then Pascal Donoghue is the leader of the Eurogroup of finance ministers. So as you can see, they're all building up quite the CV on the international and European stage. And that does lead people to wonder, are they taking their eye off the ball at home, and could it lead to bigger jobs abroad?
Cronia, we are talking a lot about Fine Gael, but this is quite damaging, I think, for Micheál Martin as well, because he effectively, and not for the first time, has been utterly walked over.
I don't know if he's being walked over, if that's his style of leadership. I mean, you could criticise it as looking like you're being walked over, and I'm sure people within his own party are worried about that and saying that. But he's very adamant about not getting involved in what he probably sees as drama. He just wants to get on with the job and leave the politics aside. I'm Taoiseach, I'm, you know, as kind of his priority, I suppose. And that was evident from the fact that he said to reporters, we move on after the story broke on the Wednesday. It was just quite naive, you know, that, you know, we're not going to get into that now. You have to tackle those issues. And the fact that he's backing Varadkar, and there has been a lot of work ongoing behind the scenes on the Mariangate issue, obviously, just because it's all quiet on the Western Front from a public point of view, it means it's frantic behind the scenes usually. But I think it's kind of the main criticism, I suppose, is Micheál Martin as leader. He seems quite quiet. He's not a leader in the traditional sense, particularly during the pandemic.
I think it's Barry Cowan in the Mail makes the point today of when the Zappone appointment came to cabinet, right, he was blindsided by it. But, you know, why didn't he just say, oh, I didn't know about that one. Can we hold off on that? We might discuss it after, or we'll bring that back at the next meeting, because I'm not sure what that's about.
But it was the last cabinet meeting of the summer as well, which is kind of where you try to bring stuff like that if you're
in Simon Coveney's speech. But if you're the chair of the meeting, you know, anyone who's chaired a local JA club knows those kind of stunts
also
get pulled. So you're ready for them, and you kind of have to go, stop, hold on there now, we'll come back to that. And you kind of
he's
push
a well experienced politician as well. You know, he well knows how things work. So it's a choice for his style of leadership more than he's being outmaneuvered here, I think. And that you know, we saw it with when he first took over the role as Taoiseach. Varadkar was trumping him, I suppose, on media appearances, and he had to kind of do a bit of a blitz afterwards. It's kind of a bit like that. It does question the leadership question for Fianna Fáil, obviously, is ongoing.
I think
as well.
The problem for Fianna Fáil is, and as I was, like, speaking to people in Fine Gael the last few days, they widely accept that they have been badly damaged by this. And Sean Coyne says as much in the Sunday Independent today, one of the few Fine Gaelers who actually agreed to go out on the media during the week to try and defend this, that Fine Gael have been badly damaged and will probably lose, someone suggested to me, 5 points in the next opinion poll.
Wow.
Now, you know, that's people talking in idle speculation, but it's... But I think the problem here is that Fianna Fáil are not going to pick up those 5 points.
Mm.
So where will those 5 points go? Maybe Fine Gael don't really transfer to Sinn Féin that much, but even a scattering of those points to independents or wherever, it means that Sinn Féin are still up, Fine Gael have dropped, and Fianna Fáil static, because they're not going. You're not going to go, God, I'm so angry at Leo Varadkar that I'm going to vote for Micheál Martin. That's the problem here.
And then I suppose that when you talk about the next generation, or you know, Pascal Donoghue, Simon Coveney, and Leo Varadkar's next job, they're young leaders. In fairness, you know, of course they're going to have, you know, Varadkar's a very young Taoiseach. And I suppose you would have another level. We're used to our leaders being a bit older, and that's the end of their political career kind of thing. So that's why that's happening. But also Fine Gael have the depth in the bench, on the benches, if that phrase can be adapted to this, another sporting analogy. Fianna Fáil, do they? It's a question, I suppose, rather than saying they don't. That is the big question for Fianna Fáil.
Yeah, Fine Gael have all their leaders eyeing up European jobs, and Fianna Fáil don't have the leaders to step up, I think might sum up that bit of the discussion there. And I found it something rather distressing in the ad break that I have two Electric Picnic virgins in the studio with me. Neither of you have been.
I think you should clarify that we haven't been to Electric Picnic. You say Electric Picnic virgins, it makes it sound like a completely different proposition.
And we also clarified we've been to other festivals.
Yes.
Because cooler ones that you wouldn't have heard of.
Yeah, of course. Would you have gone? Had it gone ahead this year, would you go to a festival this year?
I think personally in September, I may not. But at the same time, I'd like to see where we are by September. I'm due to get my second jab next week, and I feel like the last person in the country that is still waiting on one. So,
I'm with you. I'm waiting on a second this week too.
There's talk in the papers today that we're going to hit 90%. The figures are amazing, and you do reach the point where you go, if 90% of the people are vaccinated, if the festival, and I think this is the big thing, which probably hasn't got enough of the focus in all this, is that what MCD said they were going to do was have everybody there vaccinated. Yeah. So none of this thing of you get a PCR test 24 hours before, or none of this thing of if you've had COVID in the last 6 or 9 months, you can go. No, vaccinated 2 weeks prior, fully vaccinated, if you want to get in the gate. Yeah. So that, I think in some ways, could you have the full capacity? I don't know, but I think that there may have been scope for some sort of a festival here, to be honest. Whether I'd go or not, that's, well, I haven't been before, so I'm too old, baby.
I do agree, you know, when we're talking about 90% of adults being vaccinated, and then it's a festival, so the age cohort of those going would have been low to medium risk anyway. You know, you're talking about very minute risk, or low risk, for a festival. And then when you have 40,000 people at a GAA final, and there would have been an average capacity of at Electric Picnic of 70,000, they're not far off. Obviously, it's a bigger scale thing and they're mixing for a much longer space of time. But you wonder if we're at 90% vaccinated and something like a festival that hasn't happened in a long time, and the arts and culture sectors have been so hard hit, and young people have had to give up a lot when they're at low risk of COVID-19 in general. When can we do something like this? You know, that is the big question. I don't know. Like, the government's obviously very worried about the schools opening up in September and the colleges going back, and then they want people back at the offices. So that's their number one priority. And they might just say, look, we're not risking it. The schools are too big to risk.
I do wonder, is there an element perhaps among public health officials, perhaps more so than government, that if something like Electric Picnic were to go ahead, it would be a huge story. It would be lots of pictures, lots of video, lots of talk on the radio and all the rest of it. And would it seem like the bash to end all COVID, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the big reopening sort of a weekend starting with Electric Picnic.
Yeah, a little bit like Freedom Day in the UK, that basically if something like Electric Picnic went, would that herald the end of all restrictions? And I know it's kind of funny because before the ad break, we were arguing whether you could have outdoor events with 200 people or not. And now we're kind of saying, we could have an outdoor event with 70,000. And it's quite the jump when you think of it in those terms. But I mean, there does seem to be an argument there for it. And Luke O'Neill makes a very strong argument for it in the Sunday Independent today, arguing that if anything, it should be used as a way to get those younger people that have not yet, either through kind of just not bothered or laziness or else through hesitancy, not got a vaccine, that, well, maybe if they started to see things like this happening that they had to be vaccinated for, that it might get a few more jabs in the arm.
And he lists as well other festivals that have happened in Europe and that they were required either to be vaccinated or have an antigen test or have a PCR test. And the antigen PCR testing part was the volatile part that sometimes led to more cases than people wanted to lead to, but if everybody's vaccinated, as Kevin was saying, like, that is a completely different ballgame.
Yeah, he does quote a festival that happened in Utrecht in July, which had 20,000 people attending, and of those 20,000 people, 1 in 20,000 people were infected with COVID, which obviously wasn't a good result, but they could get a test to get their QR code in up to 40 hours before the event. So obviously that is very
and
different.
I think there was also, in the Netherlands, there was also problems with a lot of I think it wasn't very well policed. I remember that story at the time. And I think part of the issue there was it was very easy to swap your QR codes and your evidence of testing. So I think there was a lot of lessons were actually learned from that event. And obviously, if Electric Picnic was to go ahead, it would have to be policed very carefully in terms of proving that people were vaccinated. Mm-hmm. It's not dead yet. I think in the Sunday Times that Dermot Desmond said that he'll give it one more week, basically. Mm. He will lobby the government, but they need to get on site sooner rather than later.
Yeah, what he says, there's still time to get this happening, as in Electric Picnic happening, if we get a bit of a lobby going. We need to get on site with our whole build starting on August 16th, so exactly 8 days from today. And you'd have to say, Gráinne, we're not going to have a plan for live entertainment in 8 days, let alone this actually being allowed to go ahead.
The government said they're going to publish a roadmap for easing or removing, which is very vague, really, all remaining COVID restrictions by the end of August. So that will tell us a lot. But because of where we're at and we're talking about, you know, a very drawn out Freedom Day, essentially over probably a couple of weeks, I don't think we'll be getting it within a week's time kind of thing. But look, we're in a good place. Whether Electric Picnic happens or not, you know, that's a good argument to be having. Can we have a festival of tens of thousands of people at this stage? You know, it's not. I do feel for the arts industry, and I think the government have to do a lot to kind of supplement them, you know, particularly when they're saying, oh, you could have had up to 20 or 200 people at a gathering all this time. Mm. You know, it's just a bit of a slap in the face when so many people have sacrificed so much and they need to pump stuff back into the arts, who've been particularly hit during all of this.
It is an interesting question, Kevin, and Lucinda Creighton is writing about this in the Business Post, as to who is making the decisions, because, and we had the report from Trinity obviously during the week saying NPHET were the de facto decision makers for much of the pandemic. But in this case, Tony Houlihan was warning at the start of, or saying at the start of August, within weeks we might have an easing, and it actually seems like a political decision not to go ahead with that till September.
Well, I thought one of the most interesting things in the past week in the Zappones of Varadkar controversy is that there was no mention of NPHET at all. There was no, you know, every time we've had one of these kind of moves and clarification of guidelines, it has always involved letters back and forth between the Department of Health, the Health Minister, and Tony Houlihan. There didn't seem to be any of that this time. We're talking about Electric Picnic, and again, it sounds of the pressures back on the government. So it's kind of almost like NPHET have kind of disappeared a little bit into the background. You know, and maybe that's because we are moving towards reopening, because it was always easier to blame NPHET as we close things. But the reopening, obviously, the government wants to take credit for where we've got to. So perhaps that's part of it. But there's no doubt that there does seem to be a lot less mention of NPHET these days than there was previously. Yeah, I think you're right, Sean. I don't see how we turn around and rescue Electric Picnic in the next 8 days. It just seems inconceivable after the week that we've had in Irish politics.
But again, does beg the question, Gráinne, if we can't have it then, and remember, this is almost 2 months from now, we would be, at the rate we're going with vaccinations, as Luke O'Neill says, it should be 90% of adults or potentially more. When can those kind of things happen?
Yeah, and if they're not doing Electric Picnic, are they going to open nightclubs up or something? Like, not that they're transferable, but how far are they willing to go, if not as far as a music festival, mostly outdoors with fully vaccinated young people? You know, what can you do then? We're at a very interesting stage now where if 90% of adults are protected, a lot of underage teenagers are getting the vaccine as well, where we're talking about possibly returning to normal. But what's that normal? Is it like masks are still necessary? Will it mean that testing is still required for certain activities? You know, all of those things are going to be actually quite difficult, where we go into kind of an endemic stage rather than pandemic stage. And that needs to be debated, I think, because the public health guidance have been so important up till now, because we're not really quite used to living by the letter of what is public health appropriate. You know, when we talk about drinking too much or going into work when you have a cold, that kind of, I'd say public health experts wouldn't advise against those types of things, or in favour of those types of things. Mm. We now have to get into a stage where we're balancing that out with people continuing with their lives, you know, and, you know, quality of life is so important as well. And people have been through the mills, particularly those first 4 months of the year where things were pretty tough. We need to talk about what happens from now on when most people are vaccinated.
Yeah, and it is an interesting question. It is going to be, ironically, probably a bit of a headache for the government, Kevin, because it's a good news thing. It's a good news week. And yet it's been completely overshadowed, not only by Merriengate, but now about, well, what's next?
Yeah, and you know, the fact that they're going to come back at the end of August is promising. But you do get the sense that even at the end of August, there's going to be an element of wait and see. So, you know, we'll get some things like, it's almost certain that we'll get communions and confirmations back. Mm. And you can have granny and granddad at the party afterwards, I imagine. But where does it go from there? Because you can only string this out for so long as well. And look, there's a logic to it. And I get the whole idea that if you open it up, you don't close it down again, because we've been through that too many times. So I suppose for that to happen, you have to go on the side of caution when opening up, and you have to go slow. But there is a time when we all need to stop living our lives with an abundance of caution. And that time, I think, is coming sooner rather than later.
Fingers crossed, says all of us. That's all we've got time for, I'm afraid, on our newspaper panel today. Thanks a million to Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News at the Irish Independent, and Gráinne Nié, journalist with thejournal.ie. Thanks so much for coming in and talking us through that.
On the Record with Gavin Riley.
On News Talk